Welcome to Northern Soundings, Alaska in Conversation. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. We all have a tendency to blame or see the worst in others. But when this tendency plays out across a country, it can lead to bigger problems.
Jung studied Hitler's personality in Mussolini's and Stalin's. You know, part of his view is that when the masses get inflamed, the leader becomes a lightning rod for the psyche. And I think that's partly what's happening in Germany. That's partly what's happening here.
Jungian psychologist Stephen Parker discusses what may be behind our polarized politics. And recently, Williams Alaska Petroleum was held legally liable for a sulfalane plume that has contaminated groundwater in North Pole. UAF researcher Mary Beth Lee's work was part of the proceedings.
Sulfalane is what we consider an emerging contaminant. It's something that it's not yet very well studied, but people are discovering more and more that they do have sulfalane problems. And so now they're looking for answers like these.
And Frank Sos reviews Janet Malcolm's latest collection of essays. I hope you'll stick around. Few would deny we seem to live in very contentious political times. Congressional action appears stymied by partisan rancor. Distrust between the branches of government dominates headlines. And even looming existential threats like climate change that should rally all parties only deepens the polemical divide. All of this can make the average person angry, pensive, and distressed. Which is why I invited Jungian psychologist Steve Parker to discuss the psychology of our times. Parker has been a practicing therapist in Fairbanks for decades, and as you'll hear, he also works with Stone and has a blog. I began our discussion by asking him how he got into psychology.
I was in college in the Bay Area in the 60s, and Esalen had some programs up in our area. So I went to an Esalen workshop, and they had a guy named Fritz Perls there, who I'd never heard of. Someone gave me some tickets, said, you should go to this. I never heard of the guy, didn't know I was getting into. And he started to work with this couple who had dreams. He had people act out their dreams and talk from their dreams and work with their dreams. And up to then, I never really paid much attention to dreams or anything else. But this was really just amazing work to me. And it started me thinking that psychology was kind of a combination of both sort of intellectual interest and emotional interest. It sort of combined both streams from heart and head. So it seemed like something that would seem natural to do. I had no idea what I was getting into.
There are so many schools of psychology, of course. In the United States, we think of the behavioral psychology, and in Europe, depth psychology. What were you drawn to?
I was drawn just to understanding psychology, to what it meant to understand why we do what we do, more than a particular field of psychology.
And where did you study, and where did you find fruitful avenues for exploration or answers?
I was at Stanford University, and they had a lot of psychologists back then. Now, I was taught sort of behavioral psychology and social psychology and all kinds of different types of psychology, and nothing really connected. I mean, Gestalt psychology was pretty powerful. I think it really wasn't until I came to Alaska and started kind of really understanding what the sort of depths of trauma and problems were here that I started finding more what was necessary. And I worked a lot with hypnosis because people didn't necessarily want to talk about what they were going on. But if you did hypnosis, you could work with people with migraine headaches and so on. So that was kind of an approach to the unconscious. You weren't working directly with people. You know, it wasn't talk therapy so much as relaxation therapy or working with symbols and dreams. And also, I have to say, I was teaching a course on dreams in Cordova where I first started working as a sort of community outreach thing. You know, Robert Louis Stevenson wrote his Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde from his dreams. And I owed some creative writing, I owed some stories, and I thought, well, I can't think of anything. Maybe my dreams can help me write a story. It's just not so easy. It doesn't necessarily provide coherent stories like Stevenson did. Anyway, so I was talking about dreams in Cordova to class, and a woman there essentially said, well, you don't know what you're talking about. So we went for a walk to talk more about this. And this is Cornelia, who I live with, and we've been walking and talking about dreams now for 40 years. So then she was very Jungian. It started with Jung's memories, dreams, and reflections, and was much more depth-oriented than I had been. And so I think that really helped me turn a corner.
Now, looking at the really angry discussions taking place in society, something's missing, and that something may be hidden in the depths that isn't being expressed. So I'm looking for a psychologist like you. What do you see, Steve, when you look at the political and social landscape?
Chaos. You know, Jung was the one who brought introvert and extrovert into the language. And part of the history of it, partly, is that when he and Freud broke up, he didn't quite understand how that people could see the world so differently. And he came up with his theory of typology, and part of that is that people tend to be either extroverted, which means their attention is towards the objects of the outside world, or introverted, which means their attention is much more towards inner dynamics and the structures of the psyche. And so out of that, he developed the number of parts of the typology thing, but anyway, part of that was the introverted extroverted thing. America is about 75% extroverted, which is out of balance. So there is this tendency to think it is on the outside and not much happens. Psychology is just seen as who really wants it. And so partly necessary here is to get a balance more, to see more what's going on the inside. And I think one of my biggest problems with the way I see the current situation on the media and the journalists and the questions is people aren't asking about the psychology of things. There have been almost no questions asking what psychology is going on here that people are behaving this way. Strangely, in one of Trump's books, he said, one should study Jung. It was really, I came across this, and he said, because he really has a lot to teach about archetypes and understanding our opponents. But of course, I really doubt he's read Jung. I think this was probably his ghostwriter who said this is a good idea. So if I were a journalist, I would take that book and say, President Trump, you mentioned it's important to understand Jung. Help me understand about projection or how archetypes are affecting your work here. Because I think there's been almost no discussion. People take things that are said at face value as if there's no kind of psychology behind it. You know, what's the projection here? The idea of projection is that you take something on the inside, but since it's too uncomfortable to deal with, you project it onto the outside. So Jung talks about we project our shadow onto the other person. This is the basis of racism and stereotyping and so on. We have this sort of part of us that we don't like, we're not comfortable with, and since we don't want to have it, we put it on something that's out there. Now, Trump allegedly said something like, he's asked about, he thinks therapy is a crutch, and he said, well, what about self-reflection? No, I don't want to do that because I might not like what I see. Okay, so what I think is going on psychologically is, and not that Trump is alone in doing this, we all do this, but he's projecting characteristics on the inside onto the outside. He, for instance, he is afraid of sharks. Some of his girlfriends and some of the news media said he just can't stand the idea of sharks because he's afraid of sharks. But to me, what he's doing is projecting his own internal sharkiness out there. He thinks it's actually inside. And the whole idea of build a wall is a psychological thing. What he's trying to do there is we need a wall to keep all those immigrants out, all those bad things, all those inferior people, all those murderers, rapists, terrible people. We need to keep the shadow out. So when he gets this obsession with his wall, it doesn't have to do with the reality of it. There's so many other better ways to do it than a physical wall. But he gets this idea you have to have a wall. He sort of walls himself off from the inferior parts of his personality. He's doing this, you know, what's on the unions talk about what's on the inside is projected onto what's on the outside. So he's taking what's going on in him, which are all these parts that he doesn't want to acknowledge, and he thinks they're out there, and so he wants to build a wall to stop them. But I have yet to see there's almost no one out there questioning the psychology of what he's doing. And so when he starts calling other people liars and corrupt and all this, he's projecting stuff on, because he thinks other people are like him on the inside, and he's projecting on the outside. And the dynamics of projection are just that people take it, what's going on, at face value, and not as some, you know, what's going on psychologically that this is happening.
That's Jungian psychologist Steve Parker, and you're listening to Northern Soundings. Our conversation continues following this break.
Thank you.
Welcome back. This is Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. I'm speaking with Jungian psychologist Steve Parker about politics and emotionally coping as citizens. Let's get back to the conversation.
I know for me that I get emotionally worked up when I read headlines or some of these stories and I think, what the heck's going on? So I don't find any adequate resolution to that. What are some of the things that we might do individually in reaction to the news? And how can we maybe elevate the discourse to incorporate some of these psychological principles?
Initially, when Trump was first running for election, people used to do sort of cognitive behavioral therapy as a way to reduce, well, you're having catastrophic thinking, just tell yourself this will pass, nothing will come of it. Your anxiety is out of bounds. It didn't work with this. I mean, the catastrophic thinking was actually, in this case, probably correct. So to tell people to sort of stop being anxious just didn't work. The other thing I've seen is that the clients I've had who had the most trouble with Trump were the ones who had, frankly, who had narcissistic parents, bullies or as grandiose or doesn't pay attention to them. And they have a very, very hard time. They had extreme anxiety reaction to him. I mean, a client whose mother would go somewhere and said, well, I'm not going to be here for you, but you can look at my picture. I'm going away. And which is, you know, incredible narcissism. Like, you know, it's the picture. It's not the person. So he has brought into people's sort of awareness or consciousness or forced to deal with, how do you deal with someone who is so narcissistic? And I think that's part of what we struggle with, because all of us at some level are narcissistic. So what we're, you know, from a sort of pop psychology viewpoint, we're kind of working with the inner Trump. You know, how do we also can be like this guy. And so it's very disturbing.
One of the interesting things about Jung, of course, was he was developing psychology during a time when National Socialism was on the rise, and he was fascinated by the psychology of a country and talk about the German psychology. I don't know if that's useful, but it's certainly a different way of looking at things. Is there a lesson there for us, do you think, Steve?
Jung studied the personalities of the leaders. I mean, we studied Hitler's personality and Mussolini's and Stalin's. And in fact, he wrote, it's still classified as I understand it, but he wrote a document suggesting how to deal with the German people after the loss of Hitler. And part of the Marshall Plan came out of the way he thought it should be dealt with. So he was very, very much interested in the psychology of the situation. And you know, part of his view is that, you know, when the masses get inflamed, the leader becomes a lightning rod for the psyche. And I think that's partly what's happening in Germany. That's partly what's happening here. He reflects some kind of cultural movement that's going on that's unconscious, and people just follow him blindly. It's not, you know, people want to sort of focus on the demonically on Trump, like if we can just get rid of Trump, that we've got all our problems solved. And that just doesn't work. Trump is a reflection of the shadow of America. He's a reflection of this greed, of capitalism, of I'm number one, we're number one, let's make America great again. It's a reflection of some of the narcissistic values that America has and has had, of the racism, the bigotry. And so it's not just a single person that is the problem. I mean, it's an issue of all of us that we all have a shadow side, a dark side. And when it gets out of control, it gets terribly projected, and someone becomes a leader for that sort of unconscious element. So it really would do us all to be a little more reflective of what we're projecting on other people.
What can we as citizens do? Do you recommend certain actions or books?
You know, Churchill's advice, you know, keep calm and carry on is pretty good. The root of all religions really is the golden rule, you do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And I think that the Dalai Lama said, you know, if at all possible, be kind, it is always possible. And I think that's, to me, those are the kind of the guidance of the way through now. I mean, I have clients who just got so, and this happened back in the Gore Bush days when we had hanging chads and people couldn't stop listening and waiting and watching about this. And it was just creating more and more anxiety. So part of the issue with, you know, we've had with this election and following is people, including myself, I listen to the news a lot more than I used to because I'm worried, well, what stupid, horrible thing has happened next? So there is, you know, I'm not taking my own advice here, which would be not to quite get so concerned about it. But I think you have to sort of take it with, you know, be careful about how much news you take in. And so, you know, just not to get overwhelmingly anxious about it and do what you have to do. There's a Jungian analyst, Clara Pinkola Estes, who wrote Running with the Wolves. And she said, we are born for these times. This is what we've been trained to do. This is high stakes. We need to be out there. We need to be reflecting on it. We need to be talking about it. We need to be involved with it. I saw Joan Baez talking about her activism. And she said, 80% of the time I deny what's going on. And 20% of the time I try to do something. And I think that may be kind of a right balance here.
Years ago, I saw a film about Jung called A Matter of Heart. And at that point, it looked like a nuclear war was the big existential threat for countries. Now it seems more climate change, although it could be a descending list because there's bioterrorism and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I thought it was so fascinating that Jung is quoted as saying there's just enough rationality or reason to see us through. But he said it was like on a tipping point.
He was concerned that mankind would barely turn the corner. He had some pretty apocalyptic visions that they talk about too, and he was quite concerned that we wouldn't make it past even up to this century. And I would say, we still got nuclear war hanging over us, in addition to climate change and climate crisis.
This is Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hanna, and I'm talking this segment to local Jungian psychologist Steve Parker. When we return from the break, red eggs and psychological incubation. Listening to Northern Soundings, I'm Robert Hannon. Broadcast of Northern Soundings is made possible by listeners like you and support from the University of Alaska Fairbanks and Foundation Health Partners. A complete list of contributors can be found on the Northern Soundings page at the KUAC website. This segment, I'm talking with Jungian psychologist Steve Parker. He suffered a major heart attack years ago and recovered by tapping his creative imagination. Let's get back to the discussion.
Now, speaking of heart, you suffered a pretty serious heart attack. And how does a psychologist experience something existential like a heart attack?
Yeah, this was about 15 years ago. I had a massive heart attack. And statistically, I shouldn't be here. I mean, it was pretty massive, but I was a bit disabled from it. So part of what you do if you're a Jungian psychologist is you start, what I did was about 6 weeks after the heart attack when I was very severely, darkly depressed, I said, well, Jung started making pictures of how he was feeling. So I started making some drawings on a computer. I can't paint at all, but I can use a computer. So I started doing computer assisted drawings and did about 20 or 30 of them. And it would help. After I made the drawing, I'd be less depressed. Part of the reaction when you're wounded is you need to rest. Depression has its benefit. It's probably a good idea to be depressed after you've had a heart attack because you don't want to be doing too much. Dick Cheney, after he had his stents, did jumping jacks the next day, which is pretty absurd. Okay, so you want to rest. So I essentially rested for 2 years. But after I did the drawings about a year later, a voice in my head said, you really need to look at those images that you've drawn. And the idea was that I would sit down for the next 40 days and just write something every day about the images that I've drawn and tell the story. And so I used the treadmill as a way to recover. I was walking on a treadmill for 2 or 3 hours a day at a very slow speed so I could write and look at the internet. And so I started looking at the images I had made and tried to understand why had they occurred and when they had occurred and what they were about. There were really 40 pictures that I drew. And in more than 10 of the pictures, there was an image of a red egg. And I didn't know anything about red eggs. They seemed to want to be drawn. I mean, this is sort of the standard, often Jungian approaches. You let what happens happen. You let the psyche express itself. So I had these images, and there were lots of red eggs in them. And so then as I was trying to understand why a red egg. I mean, eggs are about possibilities and ideas, and I could comprehend that. But why red eggs? And then I came across an image of Mary Magdalene and a red egg. And the story goes that Mary Magdalene went to Emperor Tiberius after Jesus had been killed. And he was saying to her, you know, that Jesus was resurrected is no more possible than an egg in your hand can turn red. And suddenly the egg in her hand turned blood red. And he was converted at this point. So this, you know, there's some kind of image of the red egg as being connected with this experience of the self, the experience of the feminine, the experience of redemption and resurrection. And it was such an archetypal, it was like one of these, what you would call a synchronistic moment, to come up to the idea that this symbol, which I had no conscious clue about, that is something I was drawing unconsciously, was just profoundly, it shook me in my boots a bit. I mean, it was very, very, very powerful. So that really turned me into a Jungian more than anything else, I think.
And you also started a rock garden, quite an extensive rock garden. Does working with your hands an important aspect of recovery for you, Steve?
Well, part of it started out was I was looking for a place, you know, one of the things you need to do after a heart attack is really to rest and reflect. And I looked all over Alaska in some ways just for a cabin to go to and be and just watch the tide come in and out or whatever, and couldn't find a place. And I thought, well, what if I've got some acreage here? Why don't I just build a little cabin near where I live? So at the corner of the lower part of our property, I built a cabin. And as we were clearing it out, Rich, the tractor guy, ran into bedrock, these beautiful, you know, stones coming out of the ground. And he was upset because they're interfering with this bulldozer. But I said, you know, leave them there. So there are these stones, these beautiful stones. And then I thought, well, they needed a wall around them. Sort of simultaneous with that was the idea that I really needed to create a red egg in three dimensions. And there is a history of, in the ancient days of healing with Asclepius, you know, for 2,000 years, the tradition of healing was you would go to a place and you'd go to a clinic, which is a Greek term, and you would lie down and you would have a dream in this clinic, and the dream would give you advice about what you needed to do next, like find some particular herb or talk to someone or whatever. So they used dreams as a way. It was this called an incubation chamber. And so I had this image that I wanted to build an incubation chamber to heal in. And I really didn't have the technical know-how to build, you know, a large incubation chamber, but I could build an egg that one could sit in that would have somewhat the same effect. So part of the goal of the stone sanctuary is to create this, what I call a meditative red egg out of stone that you sit in and heal. And I've been working at that for 10 years. The egg's had several lives. It's been in several different places, and I finally got it where it's going to be. And I actually have clients go there, and we sit and imagine what can be healing to you. And it's a very special place, as the cabin is too. So the stone sanctuary has become manifestations of what's been going on in my psyche. And it also is a place, you know, I really think that, you know, people talk about, you know, talking is healing and all this, but place, if you can get the right place to be in, it can be very, very healing. And mm-hmm. There's something about stones that is very solid and soulful and ancient. And Jung himself built, you know, he did a lot of work with stones too. And so the question is you recommend, you know, people were just, that I was working with stones after heart problems, they thought, well, did your doctor say you could do that? And, you know, I mean, this actually started before my heart attack. It started in 2000. I had a dream in 2000 of an airplane with a red four-cylinder engine that crashed and burned. I had this dream at 5 o'clock in the morning, and a voice in my head said, I sat bolt upright, and the voice said, you have heart problems. And this was 5 o'clock in the morning, and I said, what? I was 50 years old, I was athletic, there's no way I had heart problems. But the voice said, you have heart problems. And so I went to see the doctor, we did all the tests, didn't have any heart problems apparently. 3 months later, I was walking up the hill here and had terrible chest pain and vertigo and dizziness and sweating. And sure enough, I had heart problems. So after I went through that, I was misdiagnosed in Anchorage and the severity of it, came back checking the internet. It said, you've got unstable angina, get help. A friend of mine was a doctor. He flew me down to San Francisco, put in a stent. And this all happened in 24 hours, essentially. And I was just totally shaken up because I did not, I'm 50 years old. I'm like, got this metal piece in my body. What's going on here? So for whatever reasons, this voice in my head said, you need to build a cave. So I had this Rich the Tractor guy came and we dug out a cave in the backyard. And I built this cave that's like 10 by 15 out of stone and spent all summer hauling stones and building this cave. So this was in 2001. And I went into Spenard Builder Supply and talked to Tom there. He knew I was a psychologist. And Tom said, this is right after 9/11, right? And he said, boy, what are you going to do, build a cave? I said, yeah. He was working on one, Tom. So there's some synchronicity here, too. So that started the stonework. And when I've talked about this, I talked to a heart group in Vancouver about this. And a woman came up to me afterwards crying and said, after I had a heart attack, I had to start carving stuff with stone. I started carving owls and snakes and all this, and mandalas. I didn't know what I was doing, but I just had to make the stuff out of stone, and I felt better when I carved it. And then he said, then I went to talk to some Jungian analyst, and it all started making sense. I also, there's Michael Lerner, who runs the Commonweal. It's a great, great place in San Francisco, Bolinas. And he had a heart attack, and he started moving stones around his garden after his heart attack. So I think there is something about stones because of their soulfulness, solidity, ancientness, that makes people, want to do that. And my own, the thing about working with stones, and if you got a heart attack, you shouldn't be lifting stuff heavy. That's partly true. But my own feeling was I had just been cleared in some ways. I had a stent that done all the work. They knew exactly what was there, and I was clear. So it fit. And the other thing is that you find out people even with severe congestive heart failure do better with exercise. So even if you have a heart that's severely failing, it helps to have some kind of exercise for it. So it's just do it in moderation and not to do it like suddenly shoveling snow for 3 hours a day.
More practically, we don't educate people very well to recognize the signs of a possible heart attack, do we?
Strangely, but I had two stents, three stents, and no one had taken me aside and said, if you have these symptoms, you are having a heart attack. No one. And so when I had I felt severe chest pain, I couldn't breathe, I was sweating, I thought, well, this is pretty bad heartburn, took aspirin and stuff, and it was, and it got worse and worse, and I just suddenly, asked my wife to drive me to the hospital. They also should have told me, if you're having heart symptoms, call the ambulance, don't drive there, because the people in the ambulance have the stuff in the ambulance to help you with what you need. So I wasn't even given enough information about what to do with this problem. So part of the cardiology mantra is time is heart muscle. The sooner you get treatment for a heart attack, the less damage you're going to have.
Well, Steve Parker, we're glad you're around and working with stone and patience still. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Rob.
Links to Steve Parker's blog can be found on the Northern Soundings website. When we return from the break, microorganisms play a part in a recent trial of Williams Alaska Petroleum. Welcome back. This is Northern Soundings. Many may have read earlier this month that years of legal wrangling about a sulfalane contamination coming from the North Pole refinery resulted in a multi-million dollar judgment against former owner Williams Alaska Petroleum. A Superior Court judge ordered Williams to pay over $20 million. What many may not know is that research led by University of Alaska Fairbanks microbiologist Mary Beth Lee played a role in the trial. Lee and her team looked at possible bioremediation of a miles-long plume of sulfalane that has contaminated groundwater in North Pole. I talked with Lee about her research and what it was like to testify at the trial.
Well, I have to admit it was a little scary, having not done it before, you know, realizing the importance of this case. Then I really, you know, took care to review everything that I had done, all the research that I and my collaborators and students had done to make sure I could represent it accurately and did my best to prepare to answer whatever questions they might have for me. But then it was, you know, exciting to see that our work was taking the stage and would be relevant to this case and to helping the courts decide what was fair to do.
Mm-hmm. And I can imagine one side would be more favorably inclined, whoever asked you to testify, and then the other side would be a little more adversarial.
Yeah, well, certainly I was a witness for the state, and so the trial opened with direct examination, which is the state's legal counsel asking questions and questions that I more or less anticipated that they would ask, just as a way to facilitate the process of my explaining our research and our outcomes. And then being cross-examined was the part, of course, that I was a little bit more apprehensive about, and that was the situation in which Williams's attorneys were examining and cross-examining and asking some follow-up questions. So that was an unusual experience for me. I think the closest parallel might have been my PhD defense, or a comprehensive exam for anyone who's been in graduate school. Felt a little bit like that, you know, having your research challenged and just having to, you know, make sure that you're able to justify the experiments that you did and the conclusions that you drew. And in the end, I really had no problem doing that.
Well, then let's back off then and talk about that research. As I understand, you and your colleagues sampled, took cores of this plume of sulfalane that is tied to the petroleum refinery out in North Pole. Is that right?
That's right. And our goal was to try to understand whether there was some potential for that sulfalane to biodegrade naturally in the subsurface. So we took core samples, or they were actually collected by environmental consultants that were hired by the refinery to do routine sorts of monitoring and assessment of the site. And they provided us with those samples, and we took them into the lab here at UAF. And we did a series of experiments to try to understand whether there were microbes naturally present there that were capable of biodegrading or essentially eating that sulfalane that was present. And then once we found that there were microbes that could do that, we did a series of follow-up tests to try to identify them and to understand the processes that they used for doing that, and to ultimately try to understand what might be limiting their activity in the environment.
I know research isn't cheap. How did you get your funding for this?
Well, the primary funding for this study came from the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. When this issue became clear to them, they really felt that they needed to have some objective third-party research done to fully understand the potential fate of the sulfalane in the groundwater, whether it would biodegrade on its own, what the path of the plume would be, whether there might be ways to help remediate it, things like that. So DEC approached me and my collaborator, David Barnes, here at UAF in the Institute of Northern Engineering, and together we took on this project with funding from the state as well as from Alaska INBRI, which is a National Institutes of Health funded program that's administered by UAF, and they help support one of the graduate students that worked on the project, as well as providing some of the great equipment that we were able to use in the lab.
For a layperson like myself, I think, okay, when you take these samples, there must be thousands of different microbes in any given sample. Mm-hmm. How do you tease them out once you identify one that seems to be successfully taking up sulfalane and processing it?
Yeah, we used an exciting method that's just come out in the past decade or two that makes use of isotopes to try to track the food sources that certain microbes use and to identify them. In this case, we used what's known as stable isotope probing, and we provided sulfalane in a special form. So sulfalane is made up of carbon and sulfur and some oxygen. And this particular form of sulfalane had special carbon atoms in it. And those carbon atoms were called C13. They have an extra neutron in their nucleus. And so they're a little bit heavier than normal carbon. They're not radioactive. They're just heavier. And we provided that special sulfalane to this mixture of essentially soil from core samples and groundwater, and we incubated it in the lab and watched as the microbes ate that sulfalane. And then we were able to track that isotope, that special C13, into the DNA of just the microbes that ate the sulfalane. And then by analyzing just the DNA of those organisms, we could identify them.
What led you to think that there would be microbes that would be useful this way?
We always start our research by looking into the scientific literature, and we found that as far back as the 1970s, there were reports of people using microbes in industrial wastewater treatment plant scenarios to try to lower the levels of sulfalane that were present. And there were a lot of great studies that came out of Western Canada in the 1990s and early 2000s that showed sulfalane biodegrading microorganisms in groundwater at a contaminated site. And so we were able to build upon those studies and use some of their same methods to explore what might be happening in the North Pole aquifer.
Which bacterium did it turn out that was useful for this process?
Well, we found that in the North Pole aquifer, there was really only one bacterium that was active in degrading sulfalane, and it's a member of the genus called Rhodopharax. It's closely related to a species called Rhodopharax ferrireducens, which is a microbe that's known to occur pretty broadly in the environment, and it's able to use iron in some cases instead of oxygen. But our particular organism seemed not to be able to use iron instead of oxygen to break down sulfalane. We found that it was only active in the presence of oxygen.
Help me here when you say oxygen. Does that mean that it had to be exposed to the air in order for it to start eating?
Yeah, essentially, much like our cells, many biological organisms need oxygen to complete their metabolism. And so in the case of the microbes from North Pole that could degrade sulfalane, we found that they could only do it when they had oxygen. And we provided that oxygen just by creating a swirling flask sort of experiment. So, you know, the microbes are present in the groundwater and in the soil from the core sample that we have in the flask. We have the top covered so that other microbes don't contaminate it, but there's enough permeability in the cover that oxygen can get through. And then when we put that on a shaker, that keeps it swirling, then the oxygen mixes into the water, dissolves into the water. And groundwater does have, you know, in some cases, a little bit of oxygen dissolved in it. So we were trying to simulate a very high oxygen scenario.
More than groundwater would naturally occur,
yeah,
right?
Okay. Right. So we were kind of exploring the highly oxygenated end of things, and that's much more than is actually present in the aquifer. We also did similar kinds of experiments, but in the absence of oxygen, which is much more representative of the actual subsurface, where there's low levels, but there can be zero to extremely low levels that are below what microbes can use. And we found that there was no sulfalane degradation when we didn't provide oxygen. Hmm. And this goes a long way towards explaining the size of the sulfalane plume in North Pole. We found that there are microbes that are present that can break down the sulfalane, but only when oxygen's present. And there's very little oxygen in that groundwater, as is typical for groundwater. And so this could explain why the contaminated groundwater extends 3.5 miles from the source, because there's no appreciable biodegradation happening. We can't say that there's none ever happening, because there are a few places where there's a little bit more oxygen, but certainly there's not appreciable degradation that would cause that plume to shrink.
Does temperature play a role in this as well?
It might. You know, we didn't explore that a great deal because we were trying to replicate the environment. And so we ran all of our tests at relevant temperatures, which is about 4 to 7 degrees centigrade. Temperatures, yeah, that you would find in a permafrost aquifer.
Could this technique be applied by some engineering processes?
It could, and actually it was on a smaller scale in the refinery. It's not widely known, but in the Flint Hills refinery, there was a pilot scale system implemented that injected oxygen into the groundwater, and that technology is known as air sparging. And it is commonly used to help bioremediate petroleum spills, for example, and other kinds of chemical spills in the subsurface where oxygen is needed for the microbes to break it down. And so there was a period of time when the refinery was running this small-scale experimental system, and what they found is that the sulfalane did fairly rapidly disappear when they injected oxygen. And that supported our conclusions from what we found in the lab, that when we add oxygen, the sulfalane does biodegrade. But of course, air sparging is a technology that's fairly expensive to implement, and it's not good for extremely large areas because it's challenging to really get even distribution of oxygen. You can imagine you're injecting air bubbles into a highly compacted subsurface where there's, you know, silt and clay and sand. And so it would require a lot of different oxygen injection wells very close together to really fully aerate a quite a large plume like this. So it's ultimately very impractical for the entire city of North Pole for this 3.5 by 2 to 2.5 mile wide plume to be remediated that way. Nonetheless, it's still exciting because in the future, if someone realizes they have a sulfalane problem, they could implement something like air sparging if they catch it early, and they might be able to contain that contaminant and help it to biodegrade before it travels as far as it has in this case.
I often think that it might be possible for this bacterium to be modified in such a way as to be more energetic or active in lower oxygen environments. Would that be something practical?
It is something that sometimes is done, is to genetically modify microorganisms to perform certain functions. And in the case of this organism, nobody has known before how sulfalane was biodegraded, so what genes are involved and what kinds of metabolic pathways microbes use. And we were able to use some DNA analysis to get some insight into how we think that process proceeds in this Rotopharax. And based on that information, one could, in theory, take those genes and transfer them to another organism, or maybe modify this organism so that it can function without oxygen. I think that would be a long way down the road, but it's possible that it could be done. One of the additional challenges, though, with environmental bioremediation like this is to be able to actually effectively release a high enough number of microorganisms from the lab to have them succeed in the environment and make a difference, because we would be talking about billions and billions of microbes over a very large area. But I think that something like that could be done, particularly in a smaller scale environment, like a wastewater treatment plant or a pump and treat system, maybe where one is trying to treat a more concentrated source of sulfalane, for instance.
You know, you said earlier in our discussion that there's this new technique using isotopes. And mm-hmm. Are we just at the cusp of developing the potential of microorganisms in bioremediation? Where does the field lie right now?
Well, it has a long history going back to things like oil spills and things like the Exxon Valdez, where there were a lot of discoveries made about the potential for microbes to biodegrade contaminants. And often the challenge that we face with bioremediation is trying to understand what it is that the microbes need to do their job better. In the case of the Exxon Valdez, they needed nutrients. They were running out of nitrogen, and so we added that, and they were able to be more effective. And I think that continues to be the challenge today, is to understand, of course, whether there are some microbes present that can break down chemicals, and then to find out what it is that they need to help them work more effectively. And in the case of a contaminant that's less well understood, like sulfalane, it's the biodegradation of sulfalane is not as well understood as something like petroleum that we've been studying for much longer, then we do need to make these fundamental discoveries of whether there are microbes out in the environment that can break it down in any particular environment, because they may not be everywhere, and then what it is they really need. So in this case, we found they need oxygen. They had sufficient nutrients. We did examine that in the North Pole aquifer, and there's enough there for them to do what they need to do, but they really do need oxygen.
Mm. So what will be the follow-on? Do you think, will you get more research funding to continue this study or similar studies, do you think?
Well, I think that this particular study in North Pole has wrapped
up. Run its course, yeah.
Yeah, it has, and I'm happy to see that the results were, you know, found to be useful, that I think the state now has a good understanding of how long this contaminated plume is going to be around and whether it'll disappear on its own due to biodegradation. The evidence suggests that it won't biodegrade naturally, but it may, of course, eventually dissipate just through things like dilution over time. But I have occasionally gotten inquiries already about other sulfalane contaminated sites elsewhere, because sulfalane is what we consider an emerging contaminant. It's something that it's not yet very well studied, but people are discovering more and more that they do have sulfalane problems. And so now they're looking for answers like these. And so I'm hopeful that our work will help people around the country and around the world who have a similar issue.
And there are always more court cases to look forward to, right?
Let's hope not.
Yeah, really. Mary Beth Lee, University of Alaska Fairbanks, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you, Robert.
Links to Mary Beth Lee are on the Northern Soundings website. When we return from the break, author and reviewer Frank Sose looks at Janet Malcolm's latest collection of essays. Welcome back to Northern Soundings, Alaska in Conversation. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. Janet Malcolm has enjoyed a long and distinguished career as an author and journalist. Here's reviewer Frank Sose reading a passage from Malcolm's latest book of essays.
Every writer of nonfiction who has struggled with the ditch and the bushes knows what Joseph Mitchell is talking about, but few of us have gone as far as Mitchell in bending actuality to our artistic will. This is not because we are more virtuous than Mitchell. It is because we are less gifted than Mitchell. The idea that reporters are constantly resisting the temptation to invent is a laughable one. Reporters don't invent because they don't know how to. This is why they are journalists rather than novelists or short story writers. They depend on the kindness of the strangers they actually meet for the characters in the stories.
Frank Sose reading from Nobody's Looking at You by Janet Malcolm. So Janet Malcolm, I know, has written for years for like the New York Review of Books and New Yorker, right?
Right.
And really a respected journalist and reviewer in her own right.
Yes. In fact, this piece I'm reading from is a little piece called The Master Writer of the City, which is from the New York Review of Books, but it's an appreciation of the old New Yorker writer Joseph Mitchell. And it's a complicated piece. That appreciation is a surprise coming from Malcolm. It turns out that Joseph Mitchell did have a habit of inventing, sometimes out of whole cloth, sometimes building composite characters for his pieces that appeared in The New Yorker. We think of The New Yorker as this paragon of factual accuracy, but Mitchell violated that all the time. He just made stuff up when he needed to. And Malcolm surprisingly gives him a pass. I say that because readers out there in the world are going to think, I know this woman. You've probably read pieces in this volume at some point, either in the New York Review of Books or the New Yorker, and just blew right past the byline because she allows herself to be present in an interesting sort of way. To compare her to another New Yorker writer, John McPhee, McPhee would almost rather erase himself from the narrative. And his trick is to get a person to come front and center, and he would just dissolve himself out of the story. Janet Malcolm is much more willing to say, I'm here, and I'm here because there's a story here, and I can't pretend that my presence doesn't affect that story. So there's a nice piece in here about Eileen Fisher, the fashion designer. But we see Janet Malcolm going over to her workplace and to her home and even nosing around in Eileen Fisher's own closet to see what she herself wears, right? Which surprisingly is a lot of black, white, and gray. And women who know Eileen Fisher will go, yep, that's about it. and she goes and watches a performance of the Rachel Maddow show, the left-leaning commentator. And she's very much aware of herself in the studio and of seeing Rachel Maddow on camera and off. And in this regard, you realize that we see the journalist at work in a way that other journalists often prefer not to be seen.
Well, isn't it kind of hard for almost anybody writing in Janet Malcolm's timeline and circle to escape the gravitational pull of Norman Mailer and Truman Capote with the new journalism?
Probably not. But one of the difficulties, I think, with Malcolm is that passage I just read sort of says, you know, we're all at some point or a level, another, we're kind of faking it. We're all kind of making up the details we need. I'm a little surprised, though, that she is so generous with Joseph Mistral about this, because this is where readers are going to think, I know that name. She's the woman who took down Joe McGinnis for his book, Fatal Vision, about the murdering doctor, Jeffrey McDonald. And that book became The Journalist and the Murderer, wherein Malcolm shows how Joe McGinnis, in this same very active presence way, really pretty much infected that story, not affected, but infected it, by his presence, and in a way that she felt would go completely overboard and way beyond acceptable norms. You could say that especially about Capote and In Cold Blood, which is a book where he faked a lot of stuff, as it turns out. And once again, it went sliding past the New Yorker. Fact checkers with a pass. So that's a problem. And she's very candid about that being a problem, but also maybe she thinks by showing her work, as the old math teachers used to say, we can see how she's arriving at the result she's getting.
And a lot of people, to go back to just briefly, Joel McGinnis, he wrote Going to Extremes, which dealt with Alaska, and a lot of Alaskans didn't like that.
No, we did not. We were happy when he got taken down. There is, interestingly enough, and this book, Nobody's Looking at You, is a compendium of Janet Malcolm's essays in different publications. Many of them are reactive, of course. And one of them, called Special Needs, actually focuses on the television series Sarah Palin's Alaska. And surprisingly enough, Malcolm finds Palin a sympathetic person in the end of this, and that surprised me a great deal. There's a way that many of the things that Alaskans found troubling about this show, her alleged hunting prowess and stuff, just blows right by the city girl. But she does end up feeling some sympathy for Sarah Palin and her choice to have the Down syndrome son, and that becomes the source of the sympathy here. She also writes a very sympathetic appreciation of Norman Podhoretz's autobiography. Norman Podhoretz, editor of Commentary, very right-wing guy, and her take is that this biography's been getting a lot of negative reviews because people don't like Norman Podhoretz's politics, and they can't read the book for their filters of their political distaste for him wrecking what they read. And she cuts through that and says, you know, here's a guy, he's a sympathetic guy, he's worth our attention, and he deserves a better reading than what he's getting. So in that regard, she attempts to be balanced. She attempts to be both thorough and tough, honest with the cavil of that piece I just read, that all journalists fudge it when they need to. But otherwise, this is a nice concoction of different pieces over probably about 20 years of assembled pieces. And there's an earlier concoction, too, of collected Janet Malcolm's. If people like this one, they can go back to the earlier book, which is called 41 False Starts. And from there, there are also longer book-length pieces in addition to The Journalist and the Murderer that are kind of gather her work in.
Does her style seem fairly consistent across this span of time in your estimation, Frank? Does a collection like this allow you to see, oh, she's very strong in this department and she's developed in this one or anything like that?
Yeah, this is pretty even work. She is not a flashy stylist. She has a terrific eye for detail. For example, at Eileen Fisher's, there's a cat, and there are cats in the house, and there's a cat that's sort of at the door, and she starts to let it in, and Eileen Fisher said, "Don't let that cat in. He can't be in the house. He's a troublemaker." And so later, when she goes back for a second visit, it's really cold, and she says, "Well, what about the cat?" And so the cat sort of gets a little play because she recognizes almost in the Chekhovian way, you know, you can't put a cat at the door without dealing with it. And Eileen Fisher says, "Oh, he's happy out there. The vet told me he was my healthiest cat, and he just lives under the house when it's cold, but he can't be in here because he just can't behave himself." And so she follows that on. She's very aware of Rachel Maddow's tennis shoes underneath her very professional look she has on TV, that there's this woman in sort of baggy blue jeans and tennis shoes from the waist down that you never get to see. That's the kind of thing she wants us to know about. And she trusts her eye to flesh out people through this use of careful chosen detail.
I'm talking with Frank Sose, an award-winning writer. His latest book is Unpleasantries from University of Washington Press, a collection of essays. And he's reviewing right now Nobody's Looking at You by Janet Malcolm. Thanks, Frank.
Thank you, Robert.
That's it for this edition of Northern Soundings. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. Thanks for listening.